We're at the Four Seasons Biltmore in Santa Barbara. It's a meeting on stem cell research and aging. It's a Paul F. Glenn symposium on the biology of aging. And joining me is Mark Collins, who's the executive director of the Glenn Foundation, Stephanie Lederman, who's the executive director of AFAR, which is the American Federation for Aging Research, and Michael West, who's now president of BioTime, was the founder of Geron and later Advanced Cell Technologies, right? The reason I wanted you to talk is that we don't often talk much about policy, and there was something that you raised last night and the conversation went on this morning. I wonder if you could just launch that off again for us.
Well, last night I was in a room filled with scientists, and I have to say I'm a non-scientist, but I'm very much involved in the biology of aging, and so I had an opportunity to address this group, and I decided that it would be nice to make it an interactive conversation rather than just talking. So I put three basic questions on the screen. I think, what's known about human aging? What are the most important targets that we could pursue scientifically that would return some benefit? And what should the message be about research in aging to the NIH, to the public, to Congress? And I was just a tiny bit frustrated that if I had asked a technical question, I think I could have gotten many answers. But in asking a general sort of policy, what would you like to say, given the moment to say it, about your work, there was kind of very little response. And so it's something I would like to continue to pursue. And this morning, I took up the subject again in this workshop, and Mike had arrived by that point, and I was pleased that he wanted to, in fact, address it himself.
So take the story up from there, if you would.
Well, some of us, you know, in the scientific community are not just veg scientists, but think more broadly about the human condition and the fact that we as individuals age and we lose family members from age-related degenerative diseases, and see what's happening in our society. We've got an unprecedented problem that I think anyone can see, a scientist or person on the street, or hopefully policymakers. And that's a tsunami of aging coming our way with an aging baby boom surge. It's really a tsunami. I would argue more serious than the tsunamis that we've seen in recent years and as a result of earthquakes. 76 million people tsunami. None of these tsunamis we've seen from a tidal wave impacted, or, you know, destroyed the lives of 76 million people. So we have this demographic surge facing us, which I think anyone can say, a scientist or any thoughtful person. So those of us who are working in the laboratory and are working on some of these fundamental mechanisms behind this surge of healthcare problems, the biology of aging itself, should be and are, many of us are, quite concerned that our nation prepare for this onslaught of chronic degenerative diseases and would prefer that we wake up and properly fund and get behind medical innovation to help address the problem on a personal level, improve the quality of life in aging, but we think could save our nation trillions of dollars if we were smart about this problem. So some of us do get quite energized about the issue.
But what is your, is this an implicit critique of government inaction at this point?
Or? Oh my gosh, yes. complete critique, because look, if we had a tsunami coming to our shores, that was a water-based tsunami, it was something we can all see in real time playing out in a matter of hours and days, that it impacted even a fraction of that number of 76 million Americans, and if our political leaders in Washington did nothing about it, I mean, they'd all be out of office. But here's this demographic shift that's going to be playing out over several decades, and we see, you guys could speak to it better than I. I mean, a real lack of action for the most part.
So what can you do in terms of advocacy?
Well, one of the things that I was thinking when people did not answer, you know, what can we tell the general public? I mean, I think as a person who tries to raise money for the field, we need the scientific community to be able to describe to us what they've accomplished, which is a lot, especially in the field of the biology of aging. And the more we are able to relay this information to Congress and to the general public, I would imagine there would be a groundswell of support. But for some reason, I don't know what it is, the scientific community has a tremendous problem in communicating what it is they do, how they do it, the frustrations they may have in their labs. And I think that might be, and also describing their breakthroughs, so I think that might be part of the issue of getting more money into the field. So, you know, we are trying to work with the scientific community to help them to communicate better their research and their findings, and the excitement really surrounded by the research that they do.
Now, there's a meetings on stem cells, this particular one. I mean, what's your sense of the importance of that?
I defer to Mike on the science of stem cell biology, but clearly stem cells' ability to differentiate and contribute to regenerative medicine is probably the most, one of the more exciting basic sciences in aging, and I let Mike speak to it.
Well, just in a snapshot, in a nutshell, the even currently, without this aging population, about 75% of healthcare costs are for chronic degenerative diseases. So what's so expensive, and especially going to be expensive as the population ages, are these diseases that just don't go away. The loss of cartilage in your joints, you know, that causes the painful arthritis. Your joint cannot repair itself, cannot regenerate. So what we've done, and it's really the gerontological community who started this new revolution in medicine we call regenerative medicine, is to find ways of using very powerful new stem cells that can be fashioned as means of cellular therapy to actually cause tissues to be able to regenerate that don't do so on their own. And so this new revolution in medicine we hope could be applied to the problems of aging, not just to increase healthcare costs by providing new and more expensive therapies, but by dramatically cutting the cost of healthcare and improving the quality of life. So that's where science is trying to come to the aid of our social and economic problems with an aging population.
What's the point that Tom Rando was making, though, this morning? I mean, he was talking about the costs of technology, wasn't he?
That's right. My concern is that a lot of people would knee-jerk reaction would say, aren't what we're talking about is prolonging the inevitable, you know, giving more tubes to a person on life support, you know, more and more expensive technologies. And it's really the opposite of that, that's the intent of many researchers in aging research. We're trying to find ways to allow people to live out their later years of life without these chronic, degenerative, debilitating diseases. So when you have osteoarthritis, you know, you can't climb the stairs anymore or walk to the store. And so you have to have someone, you know, bring you meals on wheels and all these kinds of things. It's trying to allow people to live a better quality of life free of debilitating diseases. And in doing so, most thoughtful economists think we can save our nation, well, trillions of dollars have been the projections. And so it'd really be foolish if we didn't, as a nation, prepare ourselves for that in that way.
But with something you describe as a tsunami, that many, 76 million.
It's a lot.
That's enough people to make a lot of that loud noise, isn't that? I mean, isn't that a big voice? Why is there not a more of a general approach to congressmen and so on and so forth?
I think part of it is a perception of time that Mike was talking about. If you want to use the tsunami analogy, these problems appear over a long period of time. So an individual's perception of what's coming down the road doesn't create a sense of urgency very often, and so it requires some foresight to think about what's coming your way and what's coming the way of the rest of the population and what's in the best interest of the country and for you and your family. So I think it's the time perspective that contributes to putting other things that are equally important perhaps in front, but continually in front. The problem is that right now we're faced with this number that Mike just alluded to, which is 76 million people, the baby boom generation of which I am at the leading edge. Turning 65 at the rate of 10,000 a day for 19 years is going to create this crushing cost on these chronic diseases of aging. So I think there's, you know, two reasons that I usually tell people that I think we should stick to in discussing this subject in keeping people engaged. And they're two very basic ones, because the science is very hard to explain. It's very detailed, very complicated, and to take it out on the street, it's hard to go somewhere. But there are two things. I think if we talk about them, we can keep people engaged. One is the alleviation of suffering. That has been the aim of medicine and medical schools since they began. I think we need to think about that as this population ages, because the amount of suffering at the end of life is really extraordinary for individuals and for their families. The other thing is the one also that Mike mentioned, which is the public treasuries cannot bear the weight of the cost of health care for these chronic diseases for 76 million baby boomers. So, and we know, the conversation has started, the public hears that we've got this large number of people turning 65. We know that the retirement age probably has to be adjusted. That's a numerical adjustment. It's relatively easy compared to some of the other things that need to be done. But we're going to face a real crisis. We may be facing rationing of healthcare. Everybody can't have everything always paid for at any time. And strategies to deal with that are the kinds of things I think that Mike is talking about. So if we're doing research on medical interventions, it would probably be a good idea to work on interventions that alleviate as many of these problems as possible. And aging research is one area where we can put some emphasis and perhaps target more than one thing at a time, not just cancer, not just diabetes, not just one aspect of things. And I think aging researchers are united in that effort to understand these underlying mechanisms that are precursors to these major diseases.
But I'd like to add that it's precisely this message that you've just said and stated quite well that needs to be delivered to the American public. I think in response to what you're saying, they don't know what to ask for this tsunami. You know, they can make a lot of noise, but they really have to ask for the right thing. One of the things that we're doing at AFAR is working with AARP in trying to deliver these messages to, at the very least, 37 million people that are members of AARP. They are very interested now in hearing about the science, they being AARP, so that the American public can be better educated, know what to ask for, and demand research that will keep them healthier longer.
I was just looking at this issue, a fairly recent issue of Scientific American, which has actually got an article in here on diseases in a dish, and it's stem cell work. And I notice here from your agenda that you've got, you're looking at telomere dysfunction, you're looking at age-related disease, muscle stem cells in disease, skeletal muscle stem cells, skin. I mean, it's a fairly wide range of things here which match the diseases in the dish thing here. So how many companies now are there out there doing this kind of work that you think would be instrumental in solving some of these problems of the biology of aging?
Far too little.
Really?
Oh, sure, because historically, you know, the large pharmaceutical companies have used chemicals, drugs, to try to treat disease. And as a result, we were really good at eliminating bacterial infections, you know, when your child has strep throat or something. And so what we're doing is piling up, rectangularizing the survivorship curve, as we say. So we're not dying when you're young, but now we're all dying from age-related degenerative diseases. And with those kinds of diseases, you know, drugs are beneficial. They can lower our cholesterol. They can, you know, help improve the quality of life. But the real important technologies, we think, for addressing the most serious chronic degenerative problems of aging, that's really the majority of these healthcare costs of the aging population, have yet to be addressed by medicine. We're just beginning to learn how to do that, but it's really the smaller biotechnology companies that are leading the way, and the total number of people in the United States working in this are in the hundreds, not the thousands, of researchers.
So, AFAR's mission is, I mean, I spoke this morning to one of your awardees, so you fund young scientists as well. What's the general mission?
The general mission is to fund and engage young scientists to get them interested in the field and ultimately develop careers in this field and obviously do very, very exciting science. And we funded over 3,000 people over the last 30 years to the tune of about $150 million. Not a lot of money, but enough to really make some kind of a dent in the field, because we believe that new ideas and new innovations are with the younger generation, and we want to get them engaged in the field.
I'm still a little bit surprised about this, because if I think about the a book like Merchants of Immortality, you know, in which you feature a great deal, Stephen Hall's book, all the way through to Aubrey de Grey's stuff, I thought there was a fairly large presence out there in terms of people talking about aging. So I don't quite see the
I see. I think what you're seeing is an explosively growing new interest in aging. But it's still, you look at an exponential growth curve, and you know we're seeing just such a rapid rise, but we're still at the beginnings of that. So what we think is that there could be, you know, if we as a nation focused, if our policy leaders focused, if our scientific community focused, the United States could lead the world one more time like it has in many other revolutions in silicon technologies and aerospace. It could lead in this area, but we're just beginning that now.
I think it's about to become involuntary, actually, for the reasons that Mike gave. It's going to become involuntary because of the numbers of people who are going to require healthcare, and that will make it a political issue. And when it becomes a political issue, it will be very much in the public eye, and I'd be surprised if it's not front and center in 2012. It really would surprise me. That's the year that the baby boom generation begins the launch of this 10,000 a day at 65. So I think the addressing the issue will, in fact, become inevitable because it will become a political and economic issue if the scientific one fails to engage people. So it will be addressed one way or another.
Have you heard any leading politicians talking about aging?
Well, I think in the past I've heard politicians talk about aging. I know that there's an advocacy group in Washington called the Alliance for Aging Research, and they engage Congress, and from time to time there are hearings and so forth. I don't think it's moved to the top of the national agenda at all, but as healthcare gets discussed more and the cost of healthcare, I would expect it'll move increasingly to the surface, because the cost of healthcare is at its highest in the aging population. You have a third of Medicare spent in the last year of life and a third of that third in the last month of life. So it's going to come up.
But I'm telling you, part of this is because there's a confusion as to what aging research is. There's a billion-dollar anti-aging movement out there making promises. The American public is confused, which is the legitimate science, which isn't. Congress is confused. What do they support? Longevity, long life? So the scientific community is very careful now in making promises and saying we want to, as Dr. West was just saying, we want to increase the health span and make people healthier longer. So that message really has to be clear. And I think once it is, and the American public supports it, actually the global public, I think we'll get more money. There's a tremendous amount of excitement in the field right now. I keep saying that, but I feel it more than ever before. So I'm excited about it. I think we just have to get the message properly disseminated.
Can I add another dimension to this? I remember in the stem cell debates in the U.S. Congress, there was a lot of discussion about where it's all heading and the ethics of mm-hmm. embryonic stem cell research right. and so on. I remember one day in the debate, someone brought up the issue, well, if the United States isn't going to do this, another country will, and they'll take mm-hmm. the market, they'll take right. the jobs. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the whole tenor of the debate shifted, pivoted mm-hmm. on a dime. And I saw U.S. members of the U.S. Congress that were equivocal or, you know, uncertain about the stem cell debate, suddenly said, wait, jobs? And there's, the United States is at a point in history where it needs to invent new industries. Many of the industries we built our history on are, you know, now part of the Rust Belt. We've lost the technological lead in automobile manufacture and maybe at some point silicon technologies. But medical research is still led by the United States. And here we have an enormous opportunity. It isn't just the United States that has an aging population. These are trillion-dollar markets worldwide, some countries having even greater problem than we do. So here's a great opportunity for us to invent a whole new area of medicine and to generate new industries. And so there's the humanitarian aspect, the scientific aspect, but the economic aspect of new job creation as well that's at risk here and it is at issue here.
So this is what you were talking about when you said you wanted to get more into the sort of philosophical issues.
Yeah, I guess I'm going to continue to press this subject because, as I mentioned, I'm not a scientist, but I'm very much involved in funding of scientists. And so part of my job is to try to determine which areas are going to have the greatest impact and benefit on these things that we're talking about. In order to do that, to get that information, I need to hear from the scientists themselves as much as others do. And so I would very much like to explore with them all of these questions. And there is a reluctance because it requires you to expose not only your scientific knowledge, but your philosophy of life. Where would you go? What would you do? Why would you do it? Well, those are important questions, and I think scientists have those opinions and feelings and really have to step into the open and begin to talk about them for our benefit.
Zach? You agree?
I agree. Yeah.
How did you get into the line of business you're in right now? Because Paul Glenn, I obviously did the interview with him along 2 years ago, perhaps now. And he told this wonderful story about the genesis of all of this, going back a long way. But how did you get
it? In my case, it was absolute happenstance. Paul was a shareholder in a company in which I was employed, and my background was in marketing. So I've always, up to that point, I had been a marketing manager or vice president or something in various companies, and they were typically acquired by bigger companies. And so in one of my transitions in life, I met Paul, and he asked me what I was going to do next, and I said, I really don't know. And he invited me to his home and said, well, perhaps you could become a consultant to me, and let's see how that goes. And I really didn't know what he had on his mind. He was interested in medical technologies, medical investing, and I thought that's probably what he wanted me to be involved with. But it turned out, he said, I have a foundation in I'm interested in the biology of aging. Would you like to take on the responsibility for doing some things with that? And at the time, he was involved with the American Federation for Aging Research and a few of the societies, but he really was kind of isolated by himself. So I began my work with him 25 years ago, and 20 years ago, I joined the board of AFAR, and that's really how I came to it, and in the years that have passed, we've managed to create programs. We do funding programs with AFAR. We have now relationships with universities around the country, and we're looking for ways in which to accomplish Paul's mission, which was to extend the healthy years of life through research in aging. So we're funding basic researchers and hoping to have an impact on these things that we're talking about.
And there's a Glenn at Center at MIT.
Yes.
Certainly one at the Salk.
Yes, there's
Andy,
one at the
Andy
Salk.
Andy Dillon.
Harvard.
You got one at Harvard.
And Stanford.
And Stanford.
For now.
How did you get into your
So I have a
business?
Master's in public health. Always had an interest, obviously, in health-related issues, and always was interested in the elderly. My background really is in health promotion, disease prevention. So aging research is all about that, health promotion. So that's my story.
And the scientist?
Well, I was always a scientist from the earliest of days, I guess. You know, born with the test tube in my hand.
Really?
Yeah. I just one of these things I gravitated toward.
Did you have a chemistry set when you were small?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And I loved biology. It's one of the most interesting pieces of science, the human body and biology in general. And as I thought about medicine, you know, where to apply, you have to focus in some area, I thought, what a great challenge to understand the biology of aging. No one's ever really understood it, and, you know, it kills everybody if you don't die from something else. So I thought, you know, one of the greatest challenges and one of the potential greatest rewards for mankind is to understand and put together this puzzle of our understanding of the clockwork mechanisms of aging, and then devise new therapeutic strategies to intervene in it for the benefit of humanity. So I just saw it as a great challenge and a great point of fascination.
I said we were outside in Santa Barbara. That's just going to hear proof of that as the train goes by blowing its whistle. Here's a question that I ask all of the people I talk to, and I think it's very apposite for you to get answers from you on this one. When the administration took over, President Obama said that as part of his speech that they would restore science to its rightful place. We didn't say where that was. What is the rightful place of science?
Can I start on that,
yeah.
being a scientist? I see science as a tool to do good or to do good bad, but a powerful tool. Science is about understanding truth, uncovering truth. It's not about dogma. It's not about my opinion versus your opinion. It's about what is, about how life works. It's about reality. And if we're going to do good in this world, to try to improve the benefit or the welfare of people we care for or society in general, I don't think you can find a more powerful means to envision ways of helping one another than building on a foundation of truth and reality. How does disease work? You know, if you really want to treat disease, the best way is to understand disease. And the best way to treat the problems of aging, improve the quality of life, which I think any rational person who goes into a nursing home today doesn't. I think we all come out with the conclusion, we can do better than this.
Right, exactly.
This is not the way we should age. And so I think the best way for us to deal with that and to do good in this world is to understand the truth about aging, what are the molecular mechanisms of it, and how as we as a society can grapple with it to help our fellow human being and to improve our economy and do all these good things. So that's how I see the role of science. It's a means to an end.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but I would say I'm a front row fan, and I have been for a long time. Science is a method and not a position, so I come to it openly with the idea that the purpose is improved knowledge, improved understanding, and the pursuit of clarity and understanding and how the world is informs us in a way that we can then act on that knowledge. Science, unlike some other ways of looking at the world, has the virtue of continually clawing away at itself for improved understanding. It doesn't survive on dogma. If somebody has a better idea than Mike tomorrow, he will surrender to it. That's the way science works, and I think that's the virtue of science. I think it's, if there's anything better to get at the truth and the way things really are, I don't know. But I think it's a good investment. It uncovers flaws all the time. It overturns its own ideas with improved understanding and knowledge. And I just can't understand why everyone isn't excited about science and enthusiastic.
I would say that several years ago, the government made a commitment. They doubled the NIH budget and made promises to hundreds upon hundreds of scientists that they should undertake careers in this area. And now there's very little money to give out to all these people that made commitments. And I think that's a disappointment. And I think that the rightful place should be back to a tripling, because science is the most important thing this country has ever contributed, I think, to the world, and can continue to do that. So to make that promise and then kind of pull back on it doesn't sit well.
There's a little book by Sir Peter Medawar called Advice to a Young Scientist. I know the two of you are not scientists, but you nevertheless give money out to young scientists. And you run companies and so on, as well as being in labs. What advice are you currently giving to young scientists? What would you tell them to do? To
keep the faith. I would say to keep, you know, your dream and aspirations, because you can solve a tremendous amount of problem. But you just have to worry about money.
You know, one thought that flashes through my mind is years ago, I trained under a scientist named Sam Goldstein, who was a pioneer in aging research and was one of the first aging researchers to use these new DNA technologies to try to decipher the role of DNA and the blueprint of life itself in aging. And his bit of advice to me as a young scientist, as he took me into his office one day and sat me down, it was probably the same advice I would give someone else, which was, he said, Mike, he says, the pursuit of science is like a boxing match. You're going to get knocked down all the time. You know, you write proposals for grants to the NIH, hopefully not to a FAR and so on, and with a great idea, and the reviewers knock you down, and or you try to publish a paper, or in the case of stem cell research, people say that, you know, you're Dr. Frankenstein and so on. He says, the secret is you got to stand back up again. Whether you win or lose a particular round doesn't matter. You have to keep standing back up. So part of, I think, the future here is tenacity, you know, to keep, as a young scientist, to keep pushing and pushing and pushing on these things and not giving up.
For my part, I don't advise young scientists at all. What I'm inclined to do is continue to press the more senior scientists that I know for ideas, for opinions. I seek out people with strong opinions. Some people are intimidated by strong opinions, and there are those who are probably pressed too hard. But I think for my part, I need information in order to make decisions or to involve others in the decision-making processes that I'm involved in. And I need the best minds to provide their thoughts and perspectives and experience so that we can figure out where to go and what to do. So I don't actually tell young people what to do. I'm probably more often seeking the opinions of their advisors and figuring out what we should do to help support the next generation of scientists from their perspective. Now, we have to take, lots of people have opinions. It's not hard to get an opinion, particularly privately. I had a hard time getting one in a large group setting, but privately you can get opinions from people all the time. And we take in the advice of lots of scientists. We can't act on all of them. They've all got their own ideas. But that's what I do. I try to get as many informed, intelligent opinions as possible so that I can address my board of directors in a way that allows them to make decisions.
I wanted to invite you to ponder for a moment on the sort of history and philosophy of this sort of area. One of the things I notice often in talking to young and to just starting students is that they're so focused on what is very much running on a treadmill. That they don't have much sense of context of the subject that they're working in. So the history and philosophy of science is something that when you give it to them, they enjoy, but it's hard to get them to actually find the time for it. Just download a PDF of a paper they need and don't even look at the front or the back of the book, you know. So I mentioned this to them, and then I asked them that if to think about if they had a chance, if I gave you a time travel token, to bring anybody to your dinner table and ask them, have a conversation with them. Is there anybody that you would really love to meet from any time?
And you're asking us that question?
Yeah. It's one I ask everybody, and it didn't seem that I should withhold it from you.
Well, I would, times past, I would have my choice of great scientists that I would love to sit down with. I can think of Isaac Newton, for instance. I'd like to know how his brain worked. But the I would say that the person I'd like to have dinner with is the scientist of 10 or 20 years from now. And the reason is that there's talk about the singularity. I'm sure many people have heard that term. But our...
This is Ray Kurzweil's concept.
Or popularized by Mr. Kurzweil. But the thought here is that our ability to uncover information, especially in the medical and biological realm, is not increasing linearly with time, but it's increasing exponentially. So we've all heard the stories about, you know, you add one drop of water to a bowl every hour, and it fills up over maybe first 58 minutes and then fills the earth 2 minutes thereafter, something like that. That's called exponential increase. And the belief is that in the electronic realm, we've seen that kind of a exponential increase in computing power and microcircuitry and so on. The belief is that that's occurring in medicine and medical research as well. And almost certainly that is true, at least to some extent. And so what we're going to see, most thoughtful researchers believe, is such an explosive growth of understanding of how life works in medicine and biology that the world of science and medicine just 10 or 20 years from now, which doesn't seem that long, is going to be so incredibly vast and growing that we'll say that virtually all of what we understand about human life and aging in this context was learned in that period of time. And we basically knew nothing before. And so I guess my first choice would be to have dinner with the scientist of 10 or 20 years from now.
Interesting. Maybe my response is a bit juvenile, but I think I'd like to have lunch or dinner with one of the key marketeers, the CEO of Google, something like that, that could really tell the story and entice the American public, get them really excited about what we do.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any ambitions to dine with someone?
Well, I've observed others answering this question, of course, and I've noticed the ones who go to the past, and Newton is a favorite, and also the occasional person who's jumped to the future, as you have, Mike. I think that's very interesting. But I have my own answer. On my wall in my living room, there's actually two images of Charles Darwin. And the reason I say Charles Darwin is because he clearly was a keen observer. So his powers of observation at a time when others were making observations too. I mean, he's not the only person to have some insight into natural selection, but clearly he made major advances in elucidating what's going on in evolution. And part of the reason I would say Charles Darwin is because of that, but also because of the remarkable situation that 200 years after Darwin, half of the people in this country believe he got it wrong. And I'm rather shocked by that. And it probably brings me back to the question of the importance of science and the investigation of the way things really are. Many of us probably would agree that this one has been gotten. The facts have been reasonably apprehended in enough basic way that we do have some understanding of evolution on Earth. And the fact that it's not embraced and in fact rejected by a large part of the population is disturbing to me, and even more wants me to be a part of elevating science, if at all possible.
Okay. Final question, what are you optimistic about?
Well, now I'm repeating myself. I'm optimistic about the future of medicine. Like I said, part of the skepticism and perhaps the sluggishness, don't you think, of the American people at least about getting behind aging research is that, you know, they're jaded. The American people are very skeptical. You know, you see all the anti-aging skin cream things
right.
on night TV, and come on, they don't really work, and they know that, or maybe most do. And the thought that we could actually understand how aging works and do something about it, I think there's a lot of skepticism about. So what I'm most enthusiastic about is that we're going to see dramatic advances in that field, and I look forward to seeing those happening, hopefully in our lifetime, depending on on the funding available through foundations. The progress we make in the aging field is really dependent on the number of scientists working on it. That's the rate-limiting effect at this point. It's not science and technology. It's people power. It's how many people at the lab bench.
Yeah, and I'm excited about the possibility that many more people will embrace science and its possibilities and be excited and support it.
And you?
I think I was born an optimist. I'm always optimistic in the face of whatever's going on. And I think there's nothing for each one of us to do except get up every morning and head the direction that you think is best to make some sort of difference.
Well, thank you all. Great to talking to you.
Thank you.